I wanted to take some time this afternoon, really excited to share with you, thank you, perfect, the fruit of quite a bit of labor on our team, which is this document that you were just given, this Principles for Parish Evangelization. We've been slow brewing this, if you want to call it that, for the last 18 months, this document. It's been on my heart to try to capture down on a piece of paper some principles for what can assist on the local level. What I want to spend some time doing really over the next 45 minutes or so is walk you through what that is and how to understand that. And I was tempted to not give it to you yet because it's impossible not to look at it because it's in front of you and you're like, what is this thing? But do your best. You're welcome to scan it. I am going to walk through it with you while I'm with you here up front. I do want to answer the important first question, though. Let's see if this thing works. Does that work? Yay. Okay. Why on earth would I even do this? Why would I spend my time? This is probably the culmination of a couple hundred hours of work between myself, Alejandra, Edgar, and Cecilia, who are on our team who work on evangelization. An immense amount of time and energy to put this in. So why would we do this? Well, there's the first obvious answer. Because this is the point. Like, that's the point. If you didn't know what was the purpose of the church, here's your quote. I'm pretty sure that Trisha actually had this in her handouts too. The vocation proper to the church, her deepest identity, she exists in order to evangelize, right? So the church is not confused about why she exists. Though I have found, if you start to ask questions, and I've done this with a couple of our parishes where we've asked this question to parishioners, what is the purpose of your parish, right? What we have found is that there is not alignment in that answer, right? So this is not the answer that's in our collective minds as Catholics generally, okay? And that, you might say, is a bit of an identity crisis we have, right? We might think, like, the church exists to distribute the sacraments, okay? We are more than Sacrament Depot, okay? Your church is more than the local branch of Sacrament Depot. And the Archdiocese is not the corporate office of Sacrament Depot, okay? We are called to carry on. There's one mission. There's literally only one mission. It's the reason the Son incarnated and came down from heaven, to seek and to save the lost. That's what Jesus says. And then he institutes a church. What does he do? He gives his mission to the church to carry on his mission. And then the church, which is both visible and invisible, heavenly and earthly, right? Like pilgrims on the way and those who've arrived. The church incarnates herself. Look how, the theology is beautiful if you think of this. Jesus became incarnate. We are his body, and his body collectively as the church is incarnated in a parish. You understand? It's very important we understand. Geographically, we are the church incarnated. We don't have a different mission. There's one mission, evangelization. And we're not confused about it. So we wanted to support the one mission, okay? Next reason, okay? Some of you may or may not be familiar with this. This has been in the Denver Catholic a bit. Archbishop speaks about this. We've come into deeper and deeper clarity at the Curia about how we will succeed at the one mission, which is so that in Jesus Christ all might be rescued and have abundant life for the glory of the Father. That's the mission of the Archdiocese. How will we succeed at that? What role does the Curia play? It's these three things. Holy priest. That's how we feel like we're going to succeed at the mission that everyone will be rescued and have abundant life. Right? Holy priest. That's not meaning, yeah. That's a whole other thing I'm not going to talk about. There's a lot to be said. You can actually read it in the Denver Catholic. We've written articles about this. The second key pillar, the second how we're going to succeed is equipped leaders for mission. That's you and I. That's why we do things like this, to equip you. Equipping, which I'll speak about here in a moment, is more than just intellectual formation, right? But we want leaders to be equipped. So this document is meant to assist in the equipping of leaders for the mission. And the third how we'll succeed is we're going to have a missional curia. And some of you are in them. Some of you maybe have heard about them. Many of you probably haven't. There's big organizational shifts happening at the Curia, at the Pastoral Center, to reorganize ourselves to be even more effective and closer to the ground to serve our parishes. These called mission support centers. Again, I'm not going to talk about that today. We've written some other stuff about that. But that's a big effort in our, it's a big initiative in our efforts to become a more missional curia to support the work where it happens on the ground, okay? Also, why did we make this document? Some of you are aware of this book. Many of you might be sick of this book, sick of the concepts. You're just like, oh my gosh, over and over and over again. But I've learned that to be a leader means to be the chief reminding officer. That's like number one job, chief reminding officer, okay? So as a reminder, we are living in a time that is more akin to the time of the apostles than it is the 1800s, okay? Because the imaginative vision of society around us is in complete contrast to the imaginative vision of the gospel, of a biblical worldview, okay? And that's what it was like for the apostles. This book, which I will not regurgitate in any way beyond that right now, you should read this book. This is a key and a core text. It will name what your experience has been if you've been living as a Christian in any way the last few years. It's really good. But the key, first priority, this is a little pop quiz. Does anybody remember the first priority for the church if she's going to become more effective in this apostolic time? Like 100 heaven points if you can get this right. No cash value redeeming for that. Put on an apostolic mindset. That's the number one first priority. We have to get our mind in the right spot, okay? And getting our mind in the right spot means understanding and being serious about the primary thing we're supposed to do, which is evangelize. John Paul II, many of you are aware of this quote. It's one of my favorites. It's getting old now. This was in the early 90s. He says, I think this is the time for the church to commit all her energies to a new evangelization. Okay? Sometimes I feel like we read that quote and we live as if he said, commit whatever's left over after you distribute the sacraments. Commit that energy to evangelization. He didn't say commit what's left over. He didn't say what's possible after you do this other things. All of your energies. I think we can all humbly admit that we have more energy we have yet to put into the first priority, okay? So these are some of the reasons why. What is the point of this document? How is it trying to serve you and the Archdiocese? This is the goal of us having written this. Our goal is to initiate, support, and guide robust local conversations about practical evangelization strategies. You'll see if you started to thumb through it a little bit. On one of the first pages, very bold at the top, it says, this is not a program, okay? This is not a prescriptive document that commands you to do certain things. That's not what this is. It's meant to initiate conversation, and not even necessarily between you and us at the Curia. You internally, locally, on your parish staff, with your pastor, it's meant to be a conversation guide. A place for you to think, to dive in, so that what will come out of it are practical evangelization strategies, okay? There's been an immense amount of energy that's been put out across the Archdiocese, and it's really courageous. A lot of energy put into trying to be creative and initiate evangelization initiatives and programs, and we want to help to continue to further that and deepen that conversation. Okay, so this document is... the simplest way to summarize it is by these two core convictions that we have, that to be an evangelizing parish, if you boil it down to the simplest things, means these two principles, okay? You're shooting after these two things simultaneously. Parishioners who are equipped to evangelize, and restructured pastoral ministry that supports and prioritizes evangelization. These are interdependent and interconnected, and you cannot do one without the other. I have tried to do one without the other, okay? When I used to be the director of evangelization at St. Joseph's in Golden, which is not far from here, just a little northwest of here, good friend Father Matt Book, who used to be the pastor here and now is our vicar for clergy, still good friends, he hired me as a director of evangelization, and I started to get really excited about evangelization. And so I started to be motivated to restructure our ministries to include things we had never included before, programs that would proclaim the gospel to people and inviting them to it. So we happened to choose at the time this program called Alpha, which we really liked and is really effective. But you know what happened is that I didn't equip anyone. So you know what happened when I ran Alpha? I kid you not. So with Alpha, it's very important that you provide a meal, a free meal. That's part of the draw. Who bought the food? Me. Who cooked the food? Me. Who set up the room every week? Me. Who led the worship? Me. Who was the one who was the MC? Me. Who was leading table conversations? Me. Who cleaned up? Me. Okay? Do you see the problem with this? That didn't last for very long. It was like, what am I doing with my life? Okay, so if you are excited to run, and you should, you must, and I'll talk about why in a minute, you must run programs that proclaim the gospel. Who staffs them if we're not equipping people? And even if I were to get volunteers, do they know what to do when they sat at a table with tattooed, unbaptized people cursing? Like, what do they know what to do in that moment to welcome them, to bring them to Christ? If I didn't equip them, they'd have no idea, right? Think of your normal volunteers in that scenario. I'm not coming back, right? Or like, God forbid, the opposite, which is like they drive people away because they get really uppity. Okay, so what is not going to work is to try to ramp up a bunch of evangelical programs without equipping people, because who on earth is going to volunteer? That's obvious. Now, the other side becomes a little less obvious. Let's say our parish got really excited, and you should, and we started equipping individual people with skills and like the knowledge of how to evangelize, and we got really good at it. Let's say we equipped like 400 parishioners with attitude, skills, and knowledge they need to evangelize, and we sent them out. What is the most obvious first step that people will do? If I'm a parishioner, I'm equipped, I go out, I start to like meet my neighbors, and I start to be serious about evangelization, my most natural impulse is to do what? Invite them back to the parish. But my parish has, what do I bring them to? What do I bring them to? It's not OCIA, I'm telling you that very clearly. It's not. It's kind of funny, but it's not. To get into OCIA, they have to have had an initial conversion. It's very clear in the documents. That is the prerequisite to enter the catechumenate. They have not. They're not even close. OCIA is for people who have chosen to become a disciple, and now we train them how to be a disciple, and then we initiate them so they can live a life of discipleship. It's not Mass, probably, right? Mass is not always the most effective or appropriate first invitation point for someone who's lost, right? It's very hard for us to empathize with what it's like to go to Mass for the first time, since we are so creatures of habit and it's so normal to us. The first time I went to Latin Mass, I happened to go to a community that did not have a missal. There was nothing for me to follow along. And I started to empathize with what it would feel like to come to a Catholic Mass as a complete outsider. I had zero clue what was going on. And now, obviously, I knew enough about theology to kind of follow it, but I was lost. And like, I have a master's degree in theology. I was lost in the Latin Mass, and no one helped me. Okay, so Mass might not be the first place. That's why we have to restructure our programs to provide places to invite people to. Because if we don't do that, we put all the responsibility on our parishioners to lead people the entire journey to a conversion in their living room by themselves. That's unreasonable. That's very, very difficult, even for extremely equipped and trained people. And in fact, it's not right to do that in a vacuum and to not bring someone to a conversion in the context of a community, to just do it in an isolated manner. Like, it's probably better that they experience your community. So what do we have for people who are barely becoming curious about the faith but have no interest in commitment? Do we have anything to invite them to? Probably not. Probably not yet. Some do, right? What do we have that for people who are curious but are not open to changing things yet, that challenges them, that walks with them as they begin to put into their life practices that change their habits, maybe to stop sinning or start praying? Do we have anything? Do we have anything to invite someone to where they would hear the gospel proclaimed and be given a clear, direct, personal invitation to respond? Do we have anything? Right, so these are some of the questions we want you to think about and ask as a part of this document. So those are the things that we feel. It's very simple. If we can equip our people and begin to restructure our programs, we're going to become an evangelizing parish. I want to give a disclaimer here. We've been working on this. We've been really deep in the weeds. And I was praying about today, and I'm praying about sharing this with you. And my greatest fear sometimes is to come off as someone who's like, I've got all the answers. I don't have the answers. This is not in any way exhaustive, this document. And what came to me was that story, maybe you remember, of Jesus who had to heal the same guy twice. Do you remember this story? It's kind of a weird story. There's a blind guy, and Jesus touches his eyes, and then he's like, I think I can see trees. And Jesus is like, let me touch you again, which is shocking, because he's like, why did Jesus have to touch him again? And then you can see clearly. What I can promise you is that this document is us seeing trees. Okay? If you come to me in a year and be like, Andrew, do you stand 100% by this without any additions? I'd be shocked if I said, yes, there's nothing I would change about this in a year. Not because this is wrong, not because I think it's in the wrong direction, it's because we're all growing as we learn how to evangelize together in the parish context. We're all in the same boat. But seeing trees is a lot better than being blind, and that's what I'm hoping this can be an aid to us. Okay, one thing that I do feel the need to introduce you to, because this is a key part of this document, is a visual diagram. You've got it in there. It's I think on page 3, that becomes a helpful tool as we try to talk about things that feel maybe a little nebulous and can be hard to describe without a visual. This visual, it's like got a little colloquial nickname. We call it the hourglass, as you can tell because it looks like an hourglass. It looks complicated, and it's less complicated than it might seem. On the bottom, what it shows in that little kind of pyramid is the pathway from being lost to being found, to an initial conversion. And it incorporates in the visual the thresholds of conversion. I'm sure that some of you have probably heard that terminology. It's been made famous in Catholic circles by Sherry Waddell, but it was not her invention. In fact, it came from a book that was called I Once Was Lost, which I cannot recommend enough. It's this incredible, full of examples, real-life examples of how do you walk with someone from totally lost to being found. So that's what's on the bottom. And then on the top, once you've had an initial conversion, so if you can see the movement of the image, everything leads to that point of initial conversion. Everything coalesces at that point. And then your life as a missionary disciple springs from your initial conversion. This is just simple theology and understanding of our path. So what happens as we come out of initial conversion is that we begin to grow simultaneously in the two universal responsibilities we're given, right? The universal call to holiness and the universal call to mission. I like this image because I find that other attempts to explain like the maturing of a missionary disciple imply that you cannot participate in the mission until you've been sufficiently built. And I firmly reject that concept. It's unbiblical. If you look at the woman at the well in John 4, she had incorrect theology, and she witnessed to her entire village. Okay, so I like this because it shows what is the reality, that we grow simultaneously in our ability to witness and our intimacy with Jesus, and they're interconnected and interdependent. Okay, because at the center of this, the crux, the hinge point is an initial conversion, I think it's actually very important that we take just a couple minutes to ask this very important question. And I ask this question because we're finding the more that we ask out and around, the less clarity we're finding out and around what constitutes an initial conversion. If this is the goal, and it is, this is the goal of evangelization, and we are not clear on what the goal is, we can go way off into tangents and kind of distract people from the goal. So this is not a rhetorical question. I actually want you to take 60 seconds at your table to not be afraid to put yourself on a limb and try to answer one of these two questions. Make sense? Okay, at your table, 60 seconds, go. Answer one of these two questions. Don't cheat and look in the document. Don't cheat. Just say what's on your heart. You bring me back to life, and it's all in the name of love, in the name of love. Name of love, in the name of love. Name of love, in the name of love. 30 seconds.
was not far behind. I was close to you. I was close to you. Carry me back to that moment in time when the colors and fragments were beautifully bright. How I long for you.
How I long. 10 seconds. Five, four, three, two, one. Okay, time's up. Anybody willing? I'm just going to take a quick sampling. A couple people, maybe three people who are brave and are willing to give an answer, their answer, or if this is a lot safer. We kind of thought this. Okay, so you don't have to put yourself in that category if that's easier. A few people. Anybody? Anybody? I don't expect St. Thomas Aquinas' definition. I just want to tell you that, okay? Yeah. Great. Who else? Yeah. Great, great. One more. Okay. Great, one more, compelled in the back. Go ahead. Great, that's simple. Yeah, there's a lot of ways to describe what we see in an initial conversion. And that's good. There's not one way to describe it. I do think it can be helpful to talk about some of the simple building blocks of what makes an initial conversion. I'm going to use one quote that I like as a starting point for this. This is St. John Paul II in his encyclical Redemptoris Missio. He defines conversion this way. Accepting by a personal decision the saving sovereignty of Christ and becoming his disciple. Okay? You will see that I have bolded those three words, a personal decision, because I find that it's been very helpful to talk about the initial conversion is an action. It affects the whole person, the whole person. So I got a couple quotes to kind of follow that up. These are all from our Holy Fathers or church documents. The first one, the General Directory, faith and conversion arise from the heart. Okay? So, well, what is the heart? Well, Pope Francis says in the second quote, the heart is intellect, will, affectivity, meaning emotions, center of emotion, intellect, will, affectivity. The final quote from Joseph Ratzinger, who you know became Pope Benedict, faith is not merely intellectual, it's not merely volitional, meaning about the will, or merely emotional. It is all of these things together, an act of the whole self, of the whole person, and his or her concentrated unity. And so it's very important, and you are all intuiting this. I want to affirm you're intuiting this, that we cannot isolate one or two aspects of the human person and say that's sufficient for conversion. We cannot stop until conversion has touched the entire whole person. This means intellect, will, and emotions, all three, okay? That's the whole person, according to Pope Francis, according to a bunch of things you can read there, the quotes I just gave you. What might it sound like? How might I have evidence that they have had an initial conversion that has touched their intellect? Well, I understand and I believe what was proclaimed to me. That's what it might sound like. Not, I understand and believe the entire catechism. That's not an initial conversion. That's way too much. That's unnecessary at that moment for an initial conversion. What is necessary? The kerygma. They have to know that. The basic proclamation of faith and understand it and agree to it. In the will, what might it sound like if you saw it in someone else? You gave great examples of this. I choose to repent and submit my life under Jesus' lordship and live as his disciple. Okay, those are really technical terms. It might not sound like that out of someone else's mouth, but that's what you're looking for. Are they turning away? Are they making a decision to turn away and live as a disciple? Just as importantly, it must affect the emotions. Okay, but it can be simple as, if you want to boil it down to, I have experienced God's personal and unconditional love for me. That is a very wide spectrum. God's love can be experienced in very gentle ways and very extreme ways. No one's requiring people to have extreme experiences of God's love. And what you'll find a lot of times is that people, especially people who've been in the church for a long time, they have experienced his love. They just might need help naming it, right? It's very rare to find someone who's like, God has never, ever loved me. It's like, I think he might have. Can we think about it? Let's talk about your story, you know? But that doesn't mean he wouldn't love them again right here now. So we can't conjure that. He's not a genie, right? But it's important we don't forget that. We like to leave that one off because we all agree, and rightly so, that if your conversion was only an emotional encounter, it's insufficient. We all know that. That's insufficient to come to faith. You actually still need to understand and believe and choose to live as a disciple. That does not mean that it is not important, okay? So we can't isolate one of the three of these or two of the three of these. We need to make sure that the conversion has touched the whole person. This might, in fact, explain why, you know, when you hear the term new evangelization, when Pope John Paul and Pope Francis, Pope Benedict speak about it, it's both to those outside the church and in the church, evangelizing those in the church. You're like, how can you say we need to evangelize people who go to Mass every Sunday? Is it possible that their initial conversion has begun but is not completed? That one of the three of these is missing? Does that make sense? And it is as simple as asking the question, hey, do you understand and believe, like, what Jesus has done for you? Maybe it's up here. They probably do, maybe not. Have you, this is one that we find a lot, have you actually given agreement to what was done on your behalf as an infant? You have to. You have to give agreement to the baptism that was given to you. This is in St. Thomas Aquinas. I can point you into the right place. That grace is bound up until you give assent to it. Maybe it's that people don't yet believe because they're not experiencing God's love for them, that that's the obstacle to them really living the fruitfulness as a missionary disciple. It can be any of these, but the importance of why I bring this up is we can't leave any of these three out, and it helps us when we're walking with someone to know what the target is. What's the goal? I want their intellect, their whole person, to be affected by the love of Christ and to come into discipleship. Okay. I don't know if I'm going to use that. Maybe. No. Okay. We'll talk maybe not today. Different day. I just want you to know, though, that if that technical language doesn't quite, it's not your jam, it's like not your thing, and you really like analogies, God has a preferred analogy for conversion, and it's marriage. The entire Old Testament, New Testament, God's preferred analogy for what his intentions are with you is marriage. That's his intention. Yes.
So I have a question. I know someone.
Yes. Probably not. He's probably had one. This is a good example. For those who couldn't hear, she had a young man who, it's clear he's had an intellectual conversion. He's living a life of discipleship. In fact, bringing people to faith and Bible studies. But he's telling her, I've never one time felt like God's loved me. So the question is, has he not had an initial conversion? I'm saying it's probable that he has, but that he needs help to name and to identify how God is loving him. That's where you would come alongside him and say, let's talk to me a bit about what your experience has been in prayer and faith. And if he still struggles in that, there's nothing stopping us from can we pray right now? God is a good father. Maybe his obstacle, okay, this is going way deep into this is a good question, but you find out that his dad is really stern, and so when he thinks about God the Father, he just thinks that God's very stern. And it's there's some work we can do to your dad is as good as he is, or bad as he is, God the Father is different. Jesus says he's much better than any human father. Are you willing to maybe suspend your belief for a minute and pretend like God is a good father and let's pray and see what he does. Like, so I would lead him. God, again, there's no dispenser for God's love. Like, you can't go and be like, come here and like put your hands out and I'm going to push the button, God's love will come to you. But we can lead them to times of prayer, Eucharistic adoration, meditations that will help them to encounter that or to restoke that fire. Yeah. And it's less about, see, again, this is a good example. It's less about checking boxes and like, oh, yep, he is, and more about what does he need? Like, what's stopping him from continuing to grow in intimacy with Jesus? And you've named it. He feels like God doesn't love him. That's the block. Now I know where I can help him. Okay? Less about like, yeah, I can analyze him, and more about how can I help him. Other scenarios, right? Someone who doesn't think the emotions matter might not even consider that. Be like, that, oh, don't worry about that. It's more about, are you living a moral life? Are you following the commandments? And we all kind of like, ugh, about that, because we know like that's not really good care of this young man. But if you only think that conversion is about intellect and will, you might not consider that that part matters. Yeah. Okay, this is a good question. All right, so the nuptial analogy, just think about that for a while. We'll talk about it a different day. Okay. Section one, I know myself and I'll go way too long on that. It's so beautiful. God wants to marry you and I. He is not satisfied with you staying at the level of intimacy of a servant. He did not die to fill heaven with janitors. He died to fill heaven with his spouses, with his children. So if your self-image of who am I to God stops at the level of servant, all I'm ever going to be is his servant, and I'm never going to be any more intimate with God, can I say something really scandalous? I think that offends him and wounds him more than the worst mortal sin you've ever committed, that you believe that lie. Because he died for you as a spouse. He died to give you intimacy and access to him that is far beyond what you probably believe is possible for you. Okay, so just know that there's more. I said I wasn't going to say it. I'm going to go on. The first section, which we dive into, how do you? Okay, so I understand that we're all motivated to evangelize. The first wall we all bump into is the how. It's always the how. How do we do it, Andrew? How do we do it? That's the point of the document, is to try to help you think through the how. Andrew, how do we equip our parishioners to evangelize? Like, do we run them through a program? Do we, like, send them, you know, to California with Trisha? That'd probably be really great. Like, but we can't do all of that, okay? So what do? We want to provide equipping that is holistic. So the beginning of this section, just as a very brief summary, talks about our equipping needs to be holistic. We really like these three simple categories to help organize our equipping of our people. Attitudes, skills, and knowledge. And they're an acronym on purpose, ASK. So if you're unsure, you should ask. Do you know how to do that? Right? Let me help you, okay? So the opposite of asking is assuming. And that's a bad acronym, okay? So you don't want the shortened acronym of assume, you want ASK, okay? Attitude, skill, and knowledge. If those words don't do it for you and you like these other ones, they are very relevant. It's about making sure their heart is in the right place, their hands know what to do, and they have in their head the right things they need. Let me give you an example, okay? Okay, let's talk about sharing testimony. This is a very important thing to be equipped in. It's a basic skill for being able to evangelize, sharing a testimony. We should help them have the right attitude. If we don't have all three of these things, you'll see how this can break down. What kind of attitude do I need to be able to be effective at sharing a testimony? These are just examples. This is not exhaustive. It might look something like this. I believe my testimony is worth sharing. Right? If you don't believe that your testimony is worth sharing, what are you not going to do? You're not going to testify. So I actually have, that sounds so obvious, but sometimes we don't name it. And you might wonder, man, that person's got an awesome testimony. Why aren't they sharing it? Don't assume. Ask. And you find out, I just honestly don't think it's worth sharing. You're like, what? Are you kidding me? Let me help you to get your heart in the right place. This is worth sharing. Or maybe they don't believe that their testimony can be more powerful than trying to teach their beliefs to somebody. I'm just making examples here. So the heart matters. The attitude matters. Because without that, we probably won't even do it. The skill also matters. It's really simple. Like, do they even know how to give a testimony? I had the incredible privilege, and I mean that very sincerely. I was at a couples group. My wife and I are in a couples group. We meet once a month. Other couples around our age, around the number of kids we have. And we started to do this thing where we asked, there's five couples, for a volunteer each time we meet to share their testimony. And this Sunday, one of the dads in my group shared his testimony for the very first time in his entire life. He had never, ever told other people the story of how he came to faith. It was an incredible privilege. It was terrifying for him. He was like literally shaking because he was so nervous to do it. And he did a great job. But at the end of that, I thought to myself, man, if someone, it was relatively obvious no one had helped him know how to do it. You know, and I was like, man, I want to help them know, like, more simply. He kind of treated it like a confessional. It was a little, like, nerve-wracking. I was like, dude, like, you don't need to tell us that stuff. I'm not a priest. I can't absolve you. And, like, it's because he doesn't know how to give a testimony. So if I had helped him, I didn't know that he was going to do it, whatever. You get the point. Knowledge. What do I need to know? Well, I need to know what makes an effective testimony, okay, so that I can become an effective witness. Because if these things are in play, I believe that my testimony is worth sharing, I'm able to share it, actually I have the skill, and I know what will make it effective, I'm a really effective witness. These are the kinds of things we want to equip our people to do, okay? And there's plenty of resources, role-playing, like different ways that you can do these equippings, okay? I do want to make one note that you don't equip each aspect in the same way. That might sound weird to say that like that. Let me say it this way. If I go to my friend who shared his testimony, let's imagine it was before his testimony, and I ask him and I find out that the gap for him, what he's lacking is that he doesn't know how to teach, or let me start it this way. He doesn't know what makes for an effective testimony. How can I fill that gap for him? It's really obvious. If it's a knowledge gap, I can teach him. That's that simple, very simple. I can teach him what makes an effective testimony. If I find out that he does not believe, doesn't have the attitude that his testimony is worth sharing, how do I fill an attitude gap? It's not teach. Inspire. Like as Tricia said beautifully, like to breathe in. Right? And that you've created an arena in which the Holy Spirit can do that work. Finally, if I find out that he doesn't know how to give a testimony, how do I fill a skill gap? It's not teach and it's not inspire. I coach him. Think about this. If I have a young person who wants to learn how to kick a penalty shot, like in soccer, whiteboarding it only goes so far. Okay? You actually have to get on the field and kick the ball. This is what happens with skills. Whiteboarding skills with people only goes so far teaching them. You actually have to try. So what I do with him, hey, let's test it out. Write a little bit, say it out loud to me, and I'll give you some feedback. Let me coach you as you do that, okay? So all three of those. All right, so that's one aspect. So when you look through the document, I'll just reference like exact pages. So if you look, for example, at page 10, if you were just to turn there for a moment. The way you'll see it organized is in those big three categories, okay? What are the attitudes that make someone an effective witness? What knowledge helps them to be effective? What skills help them to be effective? Okay, so I just wanted you to know why we use those three terms, because you're going to see them in this first section. This is an opportune moment for me to talk about the second thing that's helpful to know in this section, is that we believe that maturing in your missional identity as a missionary happens in stages and over time, okay? No one poofs out of an initial conversion with every skill and knowledge to be the most excellent evangelist. Again, the woman at the well, okay? What could she do? She could witness. Could she proclaim the gospel of the kingdom? No, she didn't know it, but she could witness. Look what he did for me. He told me everything. Okay, to proclaim is a more mature ability, if you want to say it that way. Like, we mature into that ability. You can think about the apostles, right? Think early on. Andrew meets Jesus because John the Baptist says, there's the Lamb of God, and so he goes. What does he do? He witnesses to his brother, I found the Messiah. Did he tell him any parables? Did he tell him anything about repent and believe the kingdom is here? He didn't, because he didn't know that yet, but he did witness. Eventually, what happens? Jesus sends them out to proclaim, right, the gospel of the kingdom, because they are now able to do that. And then later on, they're able to multiply. This is like St. Paul, right, who is able to multiply, raise up other people. So what you'll see in this document is that we believe, it's our conviction, don't try to bite off too much with people. I don't know if it's effective. It might be. This is Andrew's guessing. To start out by expecting people to get up and proclaim the kerygma after a session. Start simpler. Can you tell your story, how God impacted you? Can I teach you how to do that well? And then let's get comfortable with that, and then I'll teach you how you could proclaim, that's the right term, not teach, proclaim the kerygma. Okay, maybe those are interconnected. Again, maybe you don't agree, and that's fine. We find that it's helpful, that it feels more manageable to people if we can do this in stages over time. I want to draw it back to this visual diagram to help you understand why there's some weird words on here on the side, okay? So if you take the first stage of being able to witness, or as a missionary, it's witness, it's connected down here on purpose. Do you see that word's repeated? Okay? Because it means that you are able, if you are effective at witnessing, at walking someone into a relationship of trust and creating curiosity in the person of Jesus or the church. You might not yet be confident to bring them to an initial conversion, because that would be someone who could proclaim. Do you see how those are connected now? You see kind of the visual connects? It's the way the diagrams are getting. Once you're able to proclaim, you feel more confident in walking someone through, which I'm about to talk about, these thresholds at the bottom to the point of initial conversion. Ultimately, once you have been commissioned, you yourself can go out and equip others. This is like the final stage of maturity. This is you raising up other leaders, equipping them, and sending them out. That's the place we want everyone to get to be, right? A multiplying missionary disciple, right? Who can equip people and then commission them, send them out to go make other disciples. Okay, that's the first section of the document. I've been really long-winded about that. All right, the second part of this document is about restructuring pastoral ministry in the parish to support individual people evangelizing so they don't feel like they have to do it all in their living room by themselves, okay? If you'll allow me, I want to give an analogy that I think is a helpful way to talk about this, okay? This is an embassy, okay? United States Embassy in Europe somewhere, okay? I just know that it's an embassy, and I know it's in Europe. Okay. Google Images, thank you. You've all heard one of my favorite verses from St. Paul, 2 Corinthians chapter 5. You are an ambassador for Christ, as if God were appealing through you. You guys have heard that before? It's not news to you that you're an ambassador for Christ? Okay, that's good. If you extend that analogy, where does an ambassador reside? Well, at an embassy, okay? If all of us are ambassadors, what's our parish? It's an embassy, okay? Embassies do a lot of things, okay? I'm not going to go down that, but it's really fun to go down that analogy because a lot applies. I want to do one thing, though. If I am, this is a silly analogy I used with the priest last week, so Father Greg's already smiling because he knows it's silly. If I'm a French person who says, I'm done being French, I'm going to be American. I don't think there's ever been one that's ever said that, but let's imagine. Where am I going to go? Well, I'm going to go to the American embassy. And what am I going to ask them? How can I become a citizen of the United States? I'm done with France, okay? Is it logical to assume that the embassy staff will be clear and have an idea of how that could happen? Yeah, that's very logical. That's a simple question. The staff at the embassy should know how you become a citizen of that country, okay? In fact, I found this really cool image. You don't need to know all the words, but there's actually like a diagram, the pathway to citizenship of America, okay? This begs a really important question. Do we have clarity on the pathway to heavenly citizenship? You understand the analogy here? We are literally an embassy of a supernatural kingdom. That's what your parish is, in a foreign land, in the world, which is where we do not belong. We're sojourners here, okay? Let's imagine that there's someone who is trapped in the kingdom of darkness, the kingdom of Satan. I'm done. I want to be free. I want to become a citizen of Jesus' kingdom. And they come to the parish, they're not going to say it like that. Is it logical to expect, should we expect, that any of the ambassadors would know how to become a citizen? Yeah. That's like 101 to being an ambassador. This is how you can become an American, okay? But that's not always the case for us right now. This is what we want to increase our understanding of. How do you become, if you want to use the terminology, a heavenly citizen. There is a path. There is a map. There's even a diagram. We use the terms which you've heard today, thresholds of conversion. I've already mentioned where they come from. That's the original book, I Once Was Lost. I cannot recommend it enough. The people who actually did the research that found the thresholds of conversion, with permission, Sherry shared it with all of us Catholics in her book, Forming Intentional Disciples, a very important book. And then the visual diagram comes from an organization we're friends with called Catholic Christian Outreach. I'm just helping you see where that comes from, okay? So I'm talking about this section of that diagram. Why does it matter so much that not only you, but your people know the thresholds of conversion? I want you to play a little make-believe with me for a second. Maybe it's not make-believe. Let's imagine you have a favorite peak in Colorado that you like to hike, okay? If you're someone who's outdoorsy, maybe this is real. Like, you have a favorite peak, you love to hike it, you tell everybody about it, okay? And so you know, I know that there's no place in Colorado like this, but follow along, okay? That it starts out from the trailhead with a couple miles of dense forest, which leads to the lake that you have to get across. On the other side of the lake is the alpine meadow, which concludes with legitimate rock climbing to the summit, okay? I know there's nowhere in Colorado that looks like that. Just play along. Your friend, let's say your close friend, they finally decide, you know, I've heard about that. I'm going to go try that trail. And they get lost, okay? And in our imagination, they have a satellite phone, and they call you because you're the only person they know that knows this trail. And they say, help me, I'm lost. What's the first thing you're going to say to them? Where are you? And they say, I don't know. That's why I called you. So what's the second thing you're going to say to them? What do you see? Tell me what you see. What you're not going to do without asking that question is start telling them, okay, the five-point harness needs to be tight enough. You can't twist your fingers. And you need to make sure the helmet's on. You can't wiggle it. And you're looking for these kinds of finger holds and toe holds. What happens if you start sharing that information with them and they're stuck in the woods? What's the absolute best possible scenario? That you distract them from the danger they're in, if we're going to be really extreme, okay? The worst case scenario, they give up, they hang up, and they lie down and die, okay? Because you're the only one they know, okay? This is analogous to the spiritual journey. I just see this connection for a minute. When our friends, who all of them are journeying on the trail, whether they chose to or not, we're all in the spiritual journey, to or away from God, and they come to us, and they're not going to just say outright, I'm spiritually lost, help me. But they're going to say that in different words. And you might be the only Christian they know, and they expect help. But the first thing that comes out of your mouth is mountain climbing there in the trees. What's the best you can expect? To distract them from the spiritual turmoil they're in. What's the worst possible outcome? They conclude there's no hope for them because you're the only person they know, and they despair in life. That's not extreme. That's real life. Okay, we don't lack, it's my experience that we don't lack concern for our lost family members, friends, neighbors, but what happens many times is we mismatch our very well-intentioned help with where they are spiritually, and then we get frustrated when we don't see that it helps them, and we're like, what on earth? This evangelization thing doesn't work, without realizing that what we're doing is telling them about rock climbing when they're actually in the trees. We start to tell them about the Mass and the Eucharist and the moral law and blah, 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 blah. Not blah. Those are important things. But when they're not even sure that God exists, do you think that information matters to them? No. Does it land with their need? No. So understanding the thresholds is critical to make sure that your people at your parishes, they care deeply about their family members, their in-laws that have left the faith. They are desperately clawing for some way to help them. And they don't know this. And it is very, very simple. Trust, curiosity, openness, seeking. So we need to help support the thresholds in our programs so that when let's imagine Andrew as your parishioner, I'm building trust, I start to realize, oh, okay, the next thing that's going to happen is that I'm going to try to help create some curiosity in my friend about Jesus. What does my parish have that I can bring them to that will do that exact thing? Create curiosity. It's not going to require a commitment. It's not going to require a payment. It's not going to require XYZ. They're not going to have to register, okay? Do we have anything? Oh, they are curious, but they're not open to change yet. What does my parish have that I can bring them to that will help me to help them? Do you see the logic of that? So those pages are organized by the thresholds of conversion so that we can make sure that our people know that at every stage of that journey, we have done something to help them walk with someone through that stage. We want it to be, it might look something like this, a clear path. It might be windy, but like, hey, I can kind of see where that goes. What we don't want is it to feel like this, okay? Someone comes to us to become a disciple, and they look at the bulletin, and they're like, where do I start? Where do I go? Like, where does that even end? Like, I don't, like, what is this? Like, clear, simple, this is how you become a disciple and grow. And it's even more serious than kind of that silly image because it's a bit more like this. We're trying to provide a ladder out of darkness for people, okay? And we don't want it to look like the one on the left, okay? With only one thing. It's funny, but it's true, and it's sad. We expect them to shimmy up the poles and reach OCIA on their own volition, right? What if instead we had things that built trust with those around our neighborhood and people could bring them to that led to something like Inquire by the Fire, super open-ended, helps to generate, stoke curiosity, which then allows them to be invited into something a bit more systematic like the Search or Alpha, right? That like they have to commit to and their curiosity starts to deepen and starts to go towards like, I'm gonna start to try to change my life, which leads to something like we've got this example in here, like a journey group. Like, hey, let's start to learn to pray together. Come with us as we like try on change. That then leads them to a charismatic retreat where they hear the gospel proclaimed and then a clear, direct, personal invitation to conversion is given to them and they have an initial conversion and then they're ready for OCIA. Okay, so that's just an example. Like, there's a big difference between those two. And now you see why Pope John Paul II said it's going to require all of our energies. You're looking at this, you're like, oh my gosh, we can't keep hosting the Great Adventure Bible Study. Like one of those two things has got to go. It's either got to be Jeff Cavins or it's got to be this, okay? I love Jeff Cavins. I teach with a biblical school, okay? I have nothing against scriptural knowledge, okay? But yeah, you might need to let things go. And I'm stealing a little bit of Edgar's thunder. He'll come back and say this in a minute. Did you not hear in the gospel, leave the 99 behind and go in search of the one? You might have to leave some things behind to go in search of the one, to prep the way, to make the ladder sturdy so they can make it there. Okay, so that section of the document is meant to be guiding questions with as much resources as we could give you at the time. If you look, for example, at look at page 15. You'll see in that colored box, this is kind of the main thing we want you to take away. If all you ever did was ask this question regularly, what a big success. How can our parish build a bridge of trust with people in our boundaries? There's no prescription. There's an incredible amount of creative freedom of how you're going to answer that question. But it's important you ask that question. How are we building trust? And here's some goals and some examples. If you were to flip one more page to the next one, it's going to sound very similar. A guiding question. Again, if all you do is just ask that question, that's what matters. There's a lot of creative freedom. How can our parish create curiosity in people about the person of Jesus in his church? Great. We're trying to give you as much examples as we can find, but they're not prescriptive. Do it. It's going to look different for you than it is for them. Okay? All right. So that's that section. I am going to invite Edgar to come up and just say a brief word about one of the final two sections in this document, which we've labeled Going in Search of the Lost. Okay? He's coming, slowly but surely.
Thank you. Hello, everybody. My name is Edgar. I just want to share a little bit about going to seek the lost. And I want to start with just coming back to this quote from the Gospel of Luke, Luke 19:10. Why did the Son of Man come? The Son of Man came to seek and find the lost, right? That's what every parish is called to, right? We're called to go out and seek the lost, right? What we see in the book of Acts, right? Like in the book of Acts, we see how the apostles our own mission. When you read the Gospels, right, like Jesus is doing, going out to seek the lost. And the book of Acts is a continuation of that, right? A continuation of the mission, right, that has been entrusted to us as well by the virtue of our baptism. So like Andrew said, how often are we thinking about going to seek the lost? When we're planning like our ministry, how many times are we thinking about the lost? How often are we thinking about them? I think we have to change this mindset and the mentality of waiting for them to come to us, right? I think we're good at that, waiting for them to come to us. But now, in this apostolic age, we have to shift our mindset and our attitude so that we could go out and find them. Again, the parable of the lost sheep, I just want to kind of take a moment for us to reflect on that. So imagine that you're shepherding 100 sheep in the wilderness. You're out in the wilderness, and you have 100 sheep. One gets lost, right? I mean, to notice that, right, requires knowledge of the sheep that you have, right? The people that are in that sheepfold. So one gets lost. What are you going to do? Are you actually going to leave the 99 in the wilderness to go out to find that lost sheep? That's actually, in some ways, illogical, right? You wouldn't leave 99 in the wilderness. That's actually a twist in the parable. Every parable, when you read it carefully, there's a twist in it. It's actually illogical in human terms to leave 99 in the wilderness and go find one, right? So what is required of us is not only to think in human terms. When we think in human terms, we're not gonna want to leave behind our programs, the things that we're doing, like Andrew was saying, right? I recently got married, and I had, you know, when you get married, you have to leave a lot of things behind. One of them is like, I love being alone, spending time by myself. And I had to leave that behind, right? So in our ministry, when we're doing ministry, when we're planning ministry, what things are we attached to that we need to leave behind in order to commit to going out to seek the lost? So the gospel compels us not only to think about what is humanly possible, but to think in divine terms, right? If we do not put on the mind of Christ, we're not going to do that. We're going to want to do things the way that we've been doing them for who knows how long, right? And we got to be honest. A lot of these things like are not working anymore, right? So this is the question, right? Again, what do you need to leave behind in order to go out and seek the lost? I recently went to an evangelization conference with Cecilia, St. Paul Street Evangelization, and they sent us out without much equipping, right? And I realized with this that, like, actually, sometimes we actually complicate evangelization a lot more than we should, right? Obviously, we need equipping, right? But sometimes it just takes for us to just go out, right? Trust in the Holy Spirit. But especially when we have equipped. So we went out, and the encounters that we had with people were, like, incredible. They were, like, really led by the Holy Spirit, you know, a lot of those encounters. And there was some fruit in that. But one of the things that I was thinking about, imagine if every parish in this country had 2 to 3 people dedicated to going out. For 2 to 3 people in the parish to go out and seek the lost. Does anybody know how many parishes are in the country? About how many? No? It's about 17,483 parishes right now. It actually went down from about 19,000 parishes in 1988. But think about those 17,000 1,483 parishes in the country. If every parish had 2 to 3 people go out to seek the lost, how many people would that be? Anybody that could do the math? How many people would that be? It would be anywhere from 35,000 to 52,500 people going out. Imagine how many people would be reached in 1 year. If all they did was they went out once a week, how many thousands of people would come back to church, would have an encounter with the Lord, right? As simple as that. Just send out, have 2 to 3 people that go out and seek the lost. So how many, So this is our hope, right? This is what we're trying to do. We're trying to inspire you to consider this, going out to seek the lost. So thank you. That's my part on going out to seek the lost.
That's great. Thanks, brother. Thanks, Edgar. So that section of the document is just trying to be creative. There's a lot of ways to do it. We just want to spawn some thinking. Okay, and the final section is meant to be landing on a practical note. Like the one practical, well, there's a lot of practical suggestions. One that we really encourage you to consider is to form, it's our terms, you don't have to use them, an evangelization task force. What I will tell you is true is that it is insufficient to expect your priest to do it by himself. I think we all know that. It is also insufficient to have a director of evangelization and expect them to do it all by themselves. That's crazy. That's crazy, okay? So we need to actually put resources, people around that. So there's ideas of how you might organize that. And Cecilia did a lot of work thinking through this, of just kind of creating this idea. So I'm going to let her just say a couple words about what we wrote in there and what to expect in that part of the document.
Thank you. All right. At the beginning of this document, we did bold that this is not a program. We are not offering a program. And so I think it is important that we explain why we would give really just a fleshed out picture of what this could look like in our parishes. And I think a lot of us, at least myself, were absolutely dying at Andrew talking about how he led Alpha, where he literally set up, cleaned up, bought the food, did the presentation, led the tables while he was also emceeing. How many of us in ministry are actually living like that? I mean, raise your hand. Yes. So many of us. When I was in college, one of my side missions that I was given was to fill all the adoration slots at my campus adoration. And it got to the point where I couldn't find people that I'm like, wow, I guess I just won't take class on Thursday. I'm just going to spend 8 hours in adoration because I can't find anyone. And I think that's because myself and a lot of us, we have this like warm body mentality that as long as we get bodies in the room, they should want to do it because it's for the church. We shouldn't actually allow them to make it a part of their mission. We talked at the end of this presentation what the purpose of the Catholic Church is. What is the purpose of the parish? Who is paying attention? To evangelize, yes. Why do we work in ministry? To evangelize, yes. I would argue we actually work in ministry to multiply. We evangelize, but if you look at the very top of the hourglass, we're really desiring to be multiplying disciples so that we don't end up in the situation that Andrew is in at Alpha, leading everything ourselves. The reason we came up with this idea of an evangelization task force is to move away from the warm body mentality of we just need to find people to fill the spots, or me with adoration, I'm just trying to find people to fill the seats. When I just told people, okay, I need you to give up half an hour of your free time as a college student in between classes to sit in a room alone, that was the least interesting thing ever to like 99% of my classmates. But when I actually looked around, and I was living in a sorority house at the time, so lots of people who are willing to help me out, but not willing to like commit for a long period of time. When I was actually able to look around and say, hey, I'm not going to get people to fill these spots just by being warm bodies, but I can look at this individual friend who I can tell really needs some peace. instead of telling her, hey, I need you to do this thing, you might not understand it, I need you to go sit in a room and just make sure no one takes the Eucharist, because at this point, this is literally all I was looking for. I actually approached her and said, hey, I recognize that you've been really, really stressed lately, and I know I can't take any of that away from you. I can't take your classes for you. I can't take away your home pressure, everything happening with your parents. Like, I couldn't do anything about that. But what I can invite you into is something that I think would be really good for you. And that would be to once a week not be allowed to look at your phone and to just rest. I got every single slot filled, half by sorority girls in one semester. And I think looking at this vast work of evangelization, we need to start thinking like that. Bonnie and I were having an amazing conversation about this earlier, of when someone asks to volunteer, you don't just immediately assign them something without talking to them, right? You should actually ask them, where are your talents, and where do you feel like God is calling you to go? And so we did not make this prescriptively to say, you must fill these categories, but we wanted to give at least trees, again, to use Andrew's analogy, we need to at least give trees of a few different categories of people and a few different categories of positions that you could lead people and invite people into in the work of evangelization. So it's the last two pages, and it's like five pages. The last five pages of this document, everything up to like the helpful resources at the end, are just really diving into not making this a warm body position that we need someone to fill, but instead giving a fleshed out version of what we're inviting someone to, so that when we're talking to someone who wants to get involved, we can have in the back of our minds different ways that they could be involved. Going back to this just like final thought, God does not desire us to be his servant. He desires us to be his spouse. A servant is just getting all the work done. A spouse is being fruitful and multiplying. There you go.
Thanks, Cecilia. Okay, you've been really gracious and you let us talk at you for a long time. I want to give you a chance to talk with each other. I know that you haven't read the whole thing, but hopefully that was a good introduction. I want to give you like 7 or 8 minutes to, before we transition, just to digest a bit at the table. What section of everything we just talked about, you've kind of looked through this a little bit, what section of this document do you feel would generate maybe the best first conversation at a staff meeting or maybe with your pastor? You're like, you know, that one feels like it would be a really fun conversation. It would really generate good conversation. That part about equipping people, or maybe that section about going out to seek the lost, man, that one, that would be a robust conversation. So share that with your table. And then just if you're able to, if you'd like to, if you have time, how would you describe your parish's current efforts to evangelize? What's working? Where are you guys struggling? Just network and share a bit so that you know you're not alone, okay? If you need to stand up and get some water, like, go for it. I just want to give you a chance to digest together. And then we're going to take a break after we're done with this. I promise to give you a break. Okay.